Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 17th of February, these are our main stories. Hundreds of American passengers are quarantined for 2 weeks on board a cruise liner off Japan because of the coronavirus are being taken back to the United States. The governing party of France has chosen a new candidate to run for mayor of Paris, the health minister, Agnès Buzyn, after the previous candidate withdrew because of a sex scandal. Also in this podcast,
we're leaving because the government isn't keeping its side of the bargain. There's no security, either economically or physically.
Former rebels in Colombia say they're being let down after murders in government camps. And Vietnam's hosting its first cat show just 2 years after it became illegal to eat cats in the capital. The Chinese authorities say the number of new coronavirus cases is falling. This they attribute to the draconian measures they've put in place to prevent the spread of the disease. How, though, do you monitor the movement and behaviour of hundreds of millions of people? Well, the Chinese Communist Party is well placed to do so, with its control spreading all the way down to village level. And Zhu Huihui, a spokesperson for China's National Health Commission, described how the strategy has been implemented.
In terms of infection control, we have made constant improvements in our prevention and control plans, while continually monitoring and reacting to the epidemic situation. With the party and the government taking the lead, all communities were mobilized to carry out strict management and screening. We have tracked and managed the people returning from areas with a high incidence rate and those who had close contacts with patients.
Paul Moser of the New York Times witnessed how the strategy is being implemented in practice as he travelled across the country.
You get things like new checkpoints at people's building complexes where they have to maybe record information or do a temperature check. Some cities have shut down entirely to outsiders coming in. And then in the most extreme cases, probably more than 100 million people at the moment are only allowed to leave their apartment once every several days. We spoke with one woman, a professor, whose husband choked on a fishbone, and she tried to get him to the hospital. And she's in the city of Hangzhou. And because it was only one person every 2 days who was allowed to leave the apartment, she had to kind of beg and plead with party officials just to get out the door to be able to go with him to the hospital.
And blocking entry into cities and towns and villages, sometimes officials, sometimes improvisation.
Yeah, so we went to one place called Chuzhou. The police kind of met us. There are five police and a whole kind of set of checkpoints with medical workers and volunteers. And they said, we suggest you don't enter the city. You know, and we said, well, we appreciate that suggestion. You know, we're going to go into the city. And they said, no, you have to cooperate with us. So they completely block you from entering. And so then we went to another place, a city nearby called Yiwu. And Yiwu was much more sort of official about this. They had a kind of policy printed out and put on a table that people could read. And basically, unless you had written approval from your company or a fixed address in the city, you could not enter. So that's the kind of level of, you know, the thickness of these policies.
And right down at the local level, villagers, questioning people.
One guy we talked to, this guy named Bob Huang in northern Zhejiang, he was able to get out of his building complex. But when he went to a nearby village, they'd set up a roadblock and they asked a series of questions in their local dialect. And because he can't respond properly, he doesn't speak the dialect, they wouldn't let him in. But his friend that he was trying to go see had to come to the gate of the village, to this roadblock, to be able to talk to him.
And this vigilance extends to the retail sector.
The pharmacy issue is a really big one, though. In Hangzhou right now, they've stopped selling flu and cold medicine under the idea that if somebody is sick, they'll have to go to a hospital because they can't buy it. In other places, they're registering people's information if they go to a pharmacy to buy those types of medicines, which, again, is more liable to kind of scare people away as much as it is to kind of, you know, shake them out and bring them in to be checked. So you're seeing this kind of over-the-top battle going on to try and sort of drag people out and bring them in. And oftentimes it's in places with very, very few cases. In Yiwu's case, they have, I think, 24 confirmed cases so far. So it's not as if, you know, this is not Hubei, this is not the epicenter, this is hundreds of miles away. So,
and it seems that everybody's involved in these restrictions. So presumably everybody agrees?
Well, so there's a couple things going on. It may be hard to kind of comprehend how you could bring 700 million people into these levels of controls. And so, you know, China has a very, very local governance network. There's these things called neighborhood committees and grid networks, which are basically kind of very, very grassroots Communist Party members and busybodies who keep tabs on people and kind of can be called on to enforce things. Sort of hundreds of thousands of those people have been kind of mobilized. I think a lot of Chinese are very afraid right now, so they're kind of happy to go along with this. Many are also used to social control, and in time of crisis, kind of trust the idea that social controls will get them through it. But I think there's a very big question to be asked here, which is, it's the amount of social control that's kind of being put into place here. Is it really appropriate? And at times, is it not kind of, you know, counterproductive to the goals that they're trying to accomplish? And the other big question is once you sort of mobilize hundreds of thousands of non-experts to deal with a public health crisis, how do you get them to kind of back down, and how do you kind of reinstill trust?
Paul Moser speaking to the BBC's Julian Marshall. Meanwhile, American citizens have begun leaving the cruise ship Diamond Princess in Japan. Among those who chose to be flown out is Spencer Fahrenbacher, who's been keeping an audio diary about his time in lockdown off the coast of Japan.
This is the last day that I will be on the Diamond Princess. I will be one of the evacuees leaving this evening, and my cabin mate has done the same. The other two people that we're traveling with, unfortunately, do not have the same opportunity. We are very excited about leaving. We're not nearly as excited about having to do another 14-day quarantine in the U.S., but at the end of the day, I am very eager to get off the ship and get back home.
More on the evacuation now from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
We've actually seen some pictures of buses leaving from just outside the cruise ship, with some people waving from those buses, clearly very relieved to be leaving the cruise ship itself. There are, of course, though, just over 40 Americans on the cruise ship who have been infected with the coronavirus. The latest figure I have is something like 44. They will leave the ship, but they will not leave Japan. They are going to hospitals there and will receive treatment in Japan, so they won't be allowed onto this evacuation plane. But it's expected that up to 300 will be allowed to return to America. And as I say, we've seen those buses, but it is not, as was being said by Spencer there, over for them. They're going to spend 2 weeks in quarantine, and they'll spend that time on military bases in California and Texas. And that's just to ensure that nobody is carrying the virus and develops symptoms at a later date when they're back in the US and the wider community.
Meanwhile, this ship has got over 3,000 people on board. What's going to happen to the other nationalities?
Yeah, so there are other people also looking at being transferred out. Charter flights are being arranged by, among other countries, Canada, South Korea and Italy. And when you take a look at this, there is a real concern because of the concentration of the virus. We do have something like 350, more than that now, people on board the cruise ship who have been infected. And the concern when you speak to medical experts is just the fact that this effectively becomes what has been described as a hotspot for this virus. It's a people in close community and where it's easy for it to basically go from person to person, which is why there is this attempt to try and get people off the ship before they do become infected. There is also, as I say, this concern about ensuring that people do go into quarantine, that they does not allow it to spread whenever people leave. And that's partly because of what we've seen with another ship, the Westerdam cruise ship, which docked in Cambodia. Now, since it docked, there have been people who have left that ship. And one of those, an 83-year-old American passenger, she has since tested positive for the coronavirus after she landed in Kuala Lumpur. And that was despite her being screened. So it again just emphasises that people are very concerned to make sure that they handle this properly.
Chris Buckler. The French health minister, Agnès Buzyn, has replaced President Emmanuel Macron's original candidate for mayor of Paris, who was brought down by a sex scandal. Ms. Buzyn said she was out to win next month's election. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Agnès Buzyn's late entry into the Paris mayoral race could prove a stroke of good fortune. The coronavirus crisis has given her a usefully high profile. President Emmanuel Macron's party has had a torrid campaign. Its candidate, Benjamin Griveaux, was in third place when a compromising nude video of him on social media ended his chances. Prosecutors are investigating alleged breaches of privacy laws by Pyotr Pavlyensky, the exiled Russian performance artist who posted it. He says he was exposing the hypocrisy of a politician posing as a family man.
Mike Sanders. Elton John has been forced to cut short a concert in New Zealand after falling ill. The musician lost his voice midway through his set at Auckland's Mount Smart Stadium on Sunday. More from the BBC's Kate Gregan.
The moment a visibly distraught Sir Elton John was forced to call off the show was caught on camera. Breaking down in tears as he leaned against his piano, the musician shook his head before he walked gingerly off stage, helped by several assistants. Earlier in his set, Sir Elton told the sellout crowd he had been diagnosed with walking pneumonia, which is a type of lung infection and is less severe than other types of pneumonia. The 72-year-old was checked by a medic halfway through the show, and despite his illness, was able to perform classics such as Tiny Dancer. And Benny and the Jets. Hey, kid, shake a look together, 'cause all our children can don't attain the weather. But ultimately, he was unable to finish the show, his voice giving way as he attempted to sing Daniel. Despite their disappointment, the crowd shared their support for the musician. After the show, Sir Elton reached out to fans on social media, saying he's disappointed and deeply upset that he couldn't complete his performance, but he had sung his heart out until his voice could sing no more. The concert at Mount Smart Stadium was his fourth New Zealand show as part of his farewell Yellow Brick Road tour. Sir Elton is scheduled to play another two shows in Auckland next week, although these are now in doubt.
Kate Gregan. Now, here's my colleague Jackie Leonard with a request for your help for a forthcoming extra edition of the Global News Podcast.
Every day we're hearing more about the coronavirus and how it's affecting people's lives. There are so many different angles to this story. So we're going to have an extra edition of the Global News Podcast focused entirely on the coronavirus. If you have a question about it on anything from travel to prevention, treatment, politics, misinformation, the economic impact, anything in fact, just send it in and we'll see if our panel of experts can provide the answer. If you can, record yourself telling us who and where you are and what it is you want to know. Attach the recording to an email and send your question to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thank you.
And still to come in this podcast.
We don't see that this will overtake the entire funeral industry anytime soon. You know, it's a matter of offering people a new choice.
The green choice, turning human corpses into compost for environmentally friendly burials. Now, to the death of a Ugandan actress at the age of just 15 after she was diagnosed with a brain tumour. Nikita Pearl Waligwa starred in the Disney film The Queen of Katwe. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
On social media, there are many moving tributes to Nikita Pearl Waligwa. The fact that she was just 15 when she died from a brain tumour has touched a lot of people, especially those that remember her from the 2016 Disney film The Queen of Katwe. It was based on the true story of Fiona Mutesi, a 10-year-old girl from the Kampala slum of Katwe, who wasn't going to school but after learning how to play chess, went on to take part in tournaments around the world. Nikita Pearl Waligwa played the role of Gloria, who explained the rules of chess to Fiona.
In chess, the small one can become the big one.
How can I become a champion?
You must never surrender.
The director of the film, Meera Nair, described The Queen of Katwe as an inspiring story that teaches us that genius is everywhere, but we have to see it and focus on it in order to nourish it into being. The same year the film was released, Nikita was diagnosed with a brain tumour. In Uganda and many other African countries, only a fraction of patients with such serious conditions get the medical help they need. It's often just too expensive, With the treatment unavailable in Uganda, well-wishers did manage to raise the money to get help in India, and Nikita got better and went back to secondary school. But tragically, last year, another tumour was found, and she's just died in a hospital in Kampala.
Will Ross. For nearly five decades, the FARC guerrilla movement waged a war with Colombian government forces and paramilitary groups. In 2017, the two sides agreed a peace deal. In recent months, though, optimism has dwindled as many ex-FARC fighters have returned to the jungle to restart the war. They accuse the government of dishonouring the terms of the historic peace treaty. Our correspondent Matthew Charles has been to a transition camp in northern Colombia, where 12 ex-combatants have been killed by government forces in the past 3 years.
On a steep slope among the lush green of the Andes, Juan de Jesus Otero tends to his chickens. Running a farming cooperative is a striking change for Juan. In his former life, he was a FARC insurgent, and he carries the visible scars. But after the murder of 12 of his former comrades nearby, even he is frightened.
I was in the mountains for more than 30 years, and that scared me. But I'm even more scared now as a civilian with the situation we're living through.
The farm is part of the Santa Lucia transition camp, a pop-up of rickety and temporary buildings by a shallow and noisy stream. There are 24 places like this one around Colombia, built to house the former guerrillas and prepare them for civilian life. But many have become ghost towns. Of the 13,000 guerrillas that demobilised in 2017, only 3,000 remain in these camps. Many have left because they feel it's safer to go it alone. With few employment opportunities for the ex-combatants, football's become a way of passing the time in Santa Lucia. 250 rebels arrived here to give up their arms. Now just 70 remain. The atmosphere is tense and subdued. The latest murder here was just last month. Those remaining in the camp have told the government they need to move. Enough is enough, says former guerrilla commander Gustavo López.
We're leaving because the government isn't keeping its side of the bargain. There's no security, either economically or physically. So we all decided we'd leave because there's no future here.
Across Colombia, various reasons are being given for the murders. Analysts say that in the transition from war to peace, former fighters are often targeted in revenge killings. The authorities sometimes blame drug trafficking gangs that now control rural areas like Ituango. They say these groups try to recruit former rebels and can kill those who refuse to join. At a meeting in Ituango, FARC and government representatives try to work out a solution for Santa Lucia. Questions remain about where those currently living there can be rehoused or when they might be able to leave. But there's a wider warning from the former insurgents. They believe the insecurity is welcomed by some on the extreme right and even in Congress who don't want peace.
We have one battalion of the army.
That's not the case, says Emilio Achila, the presidential commissioner responsible for reintegrating the ex-combatants. He cites the measures put in place to ensure their security, including a specialist department of the Attorney General's office to investigate the killings and a police unit to respond to particular threats.
The security of ex-combat of the FARC is clearly one of our priorities. We have been working very, very hard, and we will continue to work as hard as possible in order to protect them.
Back on the farm, Juan de Jesus is frustrated that all his hard work might be lost if the ex-combatants are rehoused. I'm worried, he says, but life is worth more.
That was Matthew Charles in northern Colombia. A US firm says that it's perfected a way of turning human corpses into compost for environmentally friendly burials. Recompose claims that the process saves more than a ton of carbon compared to cremation or traditional burial. Details of a pilot study of the human composting technique were presented at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Seattle. Professor Lynn Carpenter-Boggs from Washington State University carried out the research. So just how do you go about composting a body?
We were using primarily straw, so wheat straw, wood shavings, alfalfa pellets, and some cracked corn. So very common fresh plant materials that just supply a very high amount of very readily available foods for the microbes.
And compared to burial and cremation, this is a very green way of dealing with a dead body, isn't it?
Yes, that certainly is part of the intent, is to minimize the environmental impact of the process. And because we're creating this soil-like material that can be returned to the land, it actually is supplying a material that helps to sequester carbon and promote other plant growth and soil health. So there are multiple ecosystem benefits that can come from the end product of this.
You're coming at this from the point of view of a scientist, but coming to it from a slightly different perspective, it's going to be quite difficult to overcome the ghoulish nature of this for some people. So there's going to have to be a bit of a PR job done on this, isn't there, to make people take it up?
Somewhat, yeah. It certainly is a process of dialogue with people from different backgrounds. Some people are quite excited about this. We had a very good response as far as finding research donors. So all of the research subjects that we used in our pilot study donated themselves specifically to this project. And, you know, as the first commercial facility is being developed now, in Seattle, there are many people who, you know, want to write this into their wills and want to make sure that the facility is going to be available when it comes to their time. It will be a process, and we don't see that this will overtake the entire funeral industry anytime soon. You know, it's a matter of offering people a new choice. And for some people, it will be the right one.
That was Professor Lynn Carpenter-Boggs. A quarter of a million Latin Americans live in the UK. The Elephant and Castle shopping centre in South London has been a meeting point for that community for decades. It was once a shiny vision of hope and regeneration for the future when it opened back in 1965. In fact, it was one of Europe's first covered shopping centres and was praised for its design and ambition. But it never quite lived up to the expectations, and it looks as if it's going to close its doors for good later this year. So what's to become of this hub for London's Latin American community, now threatened by a $3 billion development scheme? Russell Newlove reports.
So this is the official start of the Up the Elephant protest in support of the traders at the Elephant and Castle Shopping Centre. Big yourselves up, there's loads of people here.
A small demonstration outside a council office in Southwark, South London, protesting the decision to demolish the Elephant and Castle Shopping Centre and to relocate its traders.
I feel that the community, it's under real threat, and the Latin American sort of groups in particular.
Patria Roman, originally from Puerto Rico, is the founder of Latin Elephant, a support group for South Americans in London.
The shopping centre has been for years a space of congregation for the community, a refuge, as you said, for those people who need advice, who need help, who need just a friend to chat with over a coffee or so on. They're at risk to being lost, and that means a loss of community spaces and support groups for Latin Americans in London. And that, to me, is a very serious concern.
Just off from the shopping centre, but also under threat of closure, is Distri Andina. It's a bar, it's a cafe, it's a nightclub.
We have restaurants, bakery, we have salsa class for many years.
It's owned and run by Cesar Quintero, who opened Distri Andina almost 30 years ago after fleeing Colombia in the early 90s. As more people escaped the civil war in the country, Elephant and Castle's Latin population grew in size, and so did his bar. For him and his customers, it's more than just a business.
Colombians, Ecuadorian, Brazilian, Dominican, Bolivian. That made this Triandina so special for our community because we meet and we exchange experience, not just coming to eat or dance. They come in as well to talk, to come in and talk about their country or origins, to wait for the next job. If we close, they can find a unique point where we can meet. Even before coming to London, they know about this place, they know about the south of London that is a lot of Colombian and South America people living around here.
The number of Latin Americans in the UK is roughly estimated at around 250,000. Half of those are thought to live in London, and around 30,000 of Southwark's residents identify as Latin American. Unsurprisingly then, Spanish is widely spoken in the shopping centre.
Mi nombre es Matt, yo estoy de Egipto. Yo estaba trabajando aquí como 9 años.
Emad Megahed runs an internet cafe on the second floor of the building. Originally from Egypt, he taught himself Spanish to integrate more closely with the community he serves.
Latin people basically tend to even tell each other, if you want to go to London, go to Elephant and Castle, because this is where the Latin community are based. This is where you're going to get help. People will help each other. People will tell you what to do, where to go, how to find accommodation. So people know this is the centre hub for Latin American people.
The shopping centre is set to close for good in July and will be demolished sometime after that, an irretrievable loss for the Latin American community, campaigners say. The developers, Delancey, say they have provided a relocation fund for traders, discounts on future commercial property rents, and hired a community director to assist in all aspects of the relocation process. Even so, Patria Roman from Latin Elephant says minority groups are essentially shut out from the decision-making.
Yeah, Latin Americans are, underrepresented fully, and a lot of the migrant groups that we and ethnic groups that we work with are underrepresented in a lot of political forums, in a lot of planning forums. Planning is something that it's impacting a lot of people, you know. This is all over London. This is not just Elephant and Castle. It's not just in Tottenham or Seven Sisters. Regeneration is happening and gentrification is happening in some of London's most deprived boroughs and most ethnically diverse boroughs. And it's these populations, the ones that are being impacted by it.
Latin Americans are underrepresented in the UK. On government forms, there is no Latino option under race or ethnicity. Some even refer to themselves as the Invisibles. They say they can't be seen. And in Elephant and Castle, they're also struggling to be heard.
That was Russell Newlove. And finally in this podcast, Vietnam has been hosting its first ever cat show. They've never been held in the country before, partly because some Vietnamese people see cats as food, not pets to be pampered. But organisers of the show are determined to change people's perceptions, as the BBC's Charlotte Gallagher reports.
Around 60 pedigree cats with names like Angry Alice and D. Maria the Great were on display at the inaugural event in the capital, Hanoi. As you'd expect, they'd been shampooed, clipped and groomed ahead of their big day. Hanoi introduced a ban on eating cats in 2018, but cat meat is still sold in other areas of the country. Though as the popularity of keeping cats as pets increases, fewer people want them on menus. Nguyen Suen Cern, who organised the show, said he wanted people to see that cats are worthy of love and also prepare Vietnamese owners for competing in major international events. In the end, a bluish-grey-coloured Scotch fold called Timoso Sumo won Best in Show. But as is often the way with cats, it was hard to tell whether it was particularly impressed with the accolade.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, as usual, is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
One in two women wear the wrong foundation. Are you? Time to upgrade. Il Makiage is the boldest new brand in beauty. With 20,000 five-star reviews, their Woke Up Like This foundation is a bestseller for a reason. Available in 50 shades of flawless natural coverage, all cruelty-free. And with Try Before You Buy, it's risk-free. Take the Power Match quiz to find your perfect shade and try it free for 14 days. Go to ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.